Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This week, First Lady Michelle Obama spoke out against the terrorist organization Boko Haram, which has cited Sharia law for the kidnapping last month of nearly 300 girls in Nigeria.
This unconscionable act was committed by a terrorist group determined to keep these girls from getting an education. Grown men attempting to snuff out the aspirations of young girls.
Today on All Sides, Sharia law, what it means to modern Muslims and the rest of the world. Joining us now by phone from Toronto is the president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, Rahil Raza. Welcome to the show, Rahil.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to have an Islamic scholar on later in the program, but can you tell us what Sharia law is, what it means to you?
Well, it's far too complicated and lengthy for me to do this in a short time, but let me give you the condensed version. In the first few centuries after the advent of Islam, there were about 30 schools of legal thought, and these were very diverse, and the sum total of these legal opinions that came through these schools of thought, the principles and methodologies were collectively known as Sharia. So at that time, it was diverse, and it had various competing interpretations, and it was accepted. Now, in the Quran, which is the holy book of the Muslims, our scripture, the word Sharia is mentioned only three times, and it means moral and ethical guidance. So we use it as a guidance for our day-to-day life. However, what happened to Sharia was that it was frozen in time. And the word Sharia itself means fluidity, flowing water. And the idea was that it should evolve with time, like every law needs to. You know, you can't implement a 7th century law in the 21st century. It's like trying to stuff a VCR tape into a DVD player because the world has progressed. But Sharia got frozen and stuck in time. And it became, you know, out of date. And along a period of time for patriarchy, power, and control, men then kept on adding laws to it. The most important thing to know is that it is not divine law. It is not God-given law. This is a man-made law. And when I say man-made, I mean literally the gender man, because women were not taken into any kind of discussion and debate when the laws were being adapted. So now what we see today from all the way from Nigeria to Brunei is that anybody, any ruler, male usually, will pick up an aspect of what they want to control and call it Sharia law. But unfortunately, there are terrible things happening under the umbrella of Sharia law, and they're happening all over the Muslim world. So Sharia is like water that has been left for 7 centuries, and it started to stink. And it needs a complete overhaul within the Muslim world before they can even start about talking, before they can even start talking about exporting it anywhere. So there is a huge job ahead of the Muslim community.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Today we're talking about Sharia law. It is the law that is invoked by the terrorist organization Boko Haram, which has kidnapped the nearly 300 girls in Nigeria. If you have a question or comment, you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. Joining us by phone now from Oberlin College is Presidential Scholar in Islamic Studies, Jafar Mahalati. Welcome to the show, Jafar.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
I was just talking with Rahil Raza and getting her interpretation of Sharia law. And she said what needs to happen now is everybody has to get together and talk about it and come up with an agreed set of rules instead of these many myriad interpretations that are out there now. Has there ever been a shared set of rules when it comes to Sharia law?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the explanation of my previous speaker, who was very eloquent and mentioned the right point. The question of I have a couple of questions before I get to answer your question, and the first one is that almost anything can be abused, like the notion of freedom, for example. or equality. We know that equality was something that was abused by communism and led to millions of assassinations and murder. Freedom as much has been abused in the course of history. And Sharia, is another realm of life that has been abused. But when you go back to its philosophy and foundation, you will find out that it is a way to regulate people, to check lawlessness in a society. And when you look at the genealogy of Sharia, you see that it is a mechanism created in a society that was made up of 250 tribes who took a war and military campaign as the usual and ordinary way of life. So Sharia, when it was created and used, was to regulate human life. And I would say even with the very conservative interpretation of Sharia, it still has lots of important contribution to bring regulation to human life. And I can give a couple of examples that is actually very much relevant and related to Boko Haram and what the abhorrent things that they are doing in the name of Sharia. And that is the law of war. Ethics of war and law of war is something that was based on Sharia. And it is fascinating to learn that 4 centuries before we had this similar thing in the Christian tradition, we had an Islamic tradition of regulating war and limiting war, actually, that are still being used by people working in United Nations for conflict resolution and peacemaking. Mm-hmm. Another one is a recognition of women's right to property. And this is something that all the way till 20th century was not recognized by other systems. Mm-hmm. The gender equality in terms of the piety and many social status of Muslim societies is another production of Sharia. And one more interesting idea that I may mention is the law of endowment. This was the invention of Muslim jurists who put together parts of Sharia law and hadith and other elements and made up or invented the idea of endowment in the sense that somebody, any person can even control his property after his demise. And if we have Carnegie Foundation today in the West, or many foundations will give scholarship to students in madrasa, in schools. This has an Islamic foundation. This is rooted in Sharia law. I mean, this is things that people do not understand. And something like Boko Haram, which makes any Muslim, conscious Muslim, mortified. This is really disturbing. I don't want to continue, but follow your question, please.
Okay, is this a modern?
Could I respond to Dr. Mahalati, if you don't mind?
Rahil Rasa, sure.
Since we are on the topic, I appreciate Dr. Mahalati going into the theoretical parts of Sharia and say, and the principles and talking about how wonderful they are. But I'm more concerned as a Muslim woman about what's happening on the ground today in the name of Sharia,
right.
And that's what I'd like to discuss because what he's speaking about, I don't see happening anywhere. He speaks about women's rights and the rights to property. Well, let me give you a few examples of what is happening today, this day in Sharia. In Iraq, they're trying to pass in the constitution a Jafari law where girls as young as 9 could be married. They want to remove the minimum age of a girl to
that's
get married.
Rahil, that's what I wanted to get to. I wanted to ask Jafar Mahalati, when did it become, or at least appear to become, so much about controlling women? Despite the recognition of women's right to property and so forth, when did the control of women become, at least to the outside world, such a big deal?
Well, first of all, we have to consider everything comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a better question would be the, you know, slavery. There was, you know, for a good part of the course of history, certain things, certain phenomenon were standard in human history, like slavery, all the way till very recently was a standard. And the question is that how Sharia was dealing with this, whether Sharia was, you know, approving it or whether it created mechanism to make it demise, you know, or you know, go away, you know, after centuries or after, you know, humanity comes to maturation. I would say that Sharia was not, and this is a response to my previous speaker, is that Sharia was not a sort of fixed element of law that stayed all the way through, but rather a mechanism. It was exactly, I mean, that's why theory is so significant and important here. It was a moral venture, a moral approach, mm-hmm. To bring regulations to human society. It was not fixed, and therefore, when you study history of Sharia, for example, and I bring you to the very modern, you know, issues, like, for example, the law of inheritance, right? The, you know, in the conservative society, women had less inheritance according to law of Sharia. But the reason was that women, it was not the usual practice across the world, all geographies, that women go and become the you know, income earner of, you know, families. Mm-hmm. It were men. And therefore, because men were responsible, therefore they get a more share in inheritance. However, when it comes to modern time, and I give you one good example, like in Iran, that follows some rules of Sharia, these questions have been brought to the parliament, and there were recently approved laws that because women now are socially as active as men, you know, having less of inheritance does not make much sense and does not meet the soul of the law, and therefore it has to be changed. So, if it is approached from the right theoretical angle, Sharia law actually can be very progressive and can help, you know, liberty.
Right. In theory, Rahil, Raza, before we take a break, do you want to respond to that?
And, absolutely. Okay. I mean, we can talk about the mechanisms and theories of Sharia law till the cows come home. But as I said before, we have to look and see what's happening on the ground. Dr. Mahalati spoke about Iran. So sure, women are going to be given inheritance. But in many cases of legal jurisprudence, they're given half the value of a man. And if you have a country where there is a police that comes and checks you for the length of your dress, I have a huge problem with that. What about freedom, individual freedom?
Rahil,
I mean,
what? Are,
you know, we can't deflect the issue about what is happening in the name of Sharia today. The concept of slavery, although, you know, you've talked about it being changed, but it's happening right in front of our eyes. The concept of armed jihad. I mean, we have to speak about these issues because at a time when there were no borders, no accords, no legislation, so the tribal communities of 7th century Arabia were able to attack each other or annex each other. Mm-hmm. But today that concept is obsolete. Are our religious scholars, Dr. Mahalati, are they talking about rejecting the concept of armed jihad today? Because we have UN treaties, border control, and Muslim countries have signed on to those accords. So I'm interested in looking at the future of my children and my grandchildren and the kind of Sharia that is being practiced in Pakistan, where I come from, mm-hmm. where the Islamic Ideology Council wants to legitimize polygamy. They want to have a minimum age of marriage. I want to speak about women's rights today as being practiced under Sharia law.
My guests, Rahil Raza, president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, and also Jafar Mahalati. He's an Oberlin College Presidential Scholar in Islamic Studies. So we're going to continue our conversation on Sharia law when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Sharia law today, about a month after the terrorist group Boko Haram cited the law as the reason for kidnapping nearly 300 schoolgirls in Nigeria. Boko Haram insists that Sharia law bans Western-style education for women. Still with us is Rahil Raza. She's president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow. She was also featured in the documentary film The Honor Diaries about women in the Muslim world, and she has produced her own documentary entitled Whose Sharia Is This Anyway? Also with us by phone from Oberlin College is Islamic studies scholar Jafar Mahalati. And joining us now in the studio is the director of the Center for the Study of Religion at OSU, Dr. Thomas Kasulis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's kick it off with this question. Dr. Kasulis, can Sharia law coexist with secularism, and to what extent is this part of the conversation internationally now?
That's, I think, the question that has become particularly important, probably with the Ottoman Empire and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and the whole issue of now Turkey being the first in this situation of how do we become more Western and still maintain our Islamic identity. And that created an issue that from that point on, in the 20th century, has pretty much influenced a lot of decisions throughout the Muslim world. Let me start with a couple basic principles that I sometimes use in talking about certain issues with students. One is that, in a certain sense, there's no such thing as Islam or Judaism, Christianity or Buddhism. But there are Muslims, there are Christians, there are Jews, there are Buddhists. So when we're talking about religion, we're not talking about a thing that has belief, a thing that does things. Only people have beliefs. Only people do things. And take the case of Islam, you have something like 1.2 to 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. Guess what? Some of them are crazy, right? And so we have to put this in context. Secondly, Islam, because it is not a thing, but there are Muslims, each culture is going to have its impact on Islam. And this become a person is not only a Muslim. A person is an American Muslim. A person is a Nigerian Muslim. A person is a Syrian Muslim, a Pakistani Muslim. So therefore, Islam has to interface with the culture in which it finds itself. And today, this becomes the issue, going to your question, of but these cultures are now part of a modern global society with certain liberal democratic principles of rights and so forth. How then can you maintain your Muslim identity with this modern contemporary world identity? And this is where a lot of the issues and intentions come in. And one last point that Rahil had pointed out in her comments was that she's concerned about people taking one aspect of Sharia and emphasizing that for their own purposes. Again, as an analogy sometimes in talking about certain religious phenomena, I tell my students religion's not all that different from a language. Language isn't good or bad. Good people use language to do good things and say good things. Bad people use language to do bad things and say bad things. And there are going to be bad people who will pick and choose this passage or that passage or this ruling from Sharia law and do bad things, just as there will be people who will do good things picking different passages.
Kind of like what Jafar Mahalati said earlier, that people have abused the concept of equality, they've abused the concept of freedom, right. And Sharia is just another concept that is being abused or
exactly.
misused.
Yeah, and like a concept like freedom, Sharia has a long history of many interpreters. So therefore, there's a lot to pick and choose from. For example, if you're a Christian, do you read the passage where Jesus said, I come to turn father against son and brother against brother? Or do you read the passage of love your enemies and turn the other cheek and love thy neighbor as thyself? Mm-hmm. Which passage are you going to choose to make the focus? And so I think this is part of the problem, is that we have to recognize that a corpus of tradition as big as Sharia does not have a univocal statement, and it needs interpretation, and it's up to the people, the Muslims, to interpret their Sharia, and this ultimately will have to be interpreting the Sharia today for this world, for our society.
Jafar Mahalati, what about the idea of Sharia law coexisting with secularism? Is it possible? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you, and thank you for my explanation of Dr. Kasula. That was I 100% agree with. My first response is that what is the solution and what kind of approach, theoretical approach, we have for this you know, for the solution. Mm-hmm. One approach is to see that a few people are abusing Sharia, and therefore we say that forget about Sharia altogether and go to civil and common law and other kind of international laws. And therefore, it's sort of an exclusion. Another one is to make reform within Sharia, to go, you know, within Sharia and discuss all of these secular issues, you know, civil liberties, this and that, within Sharia. And that is actually much more productive than going around Sharia.
But who is invited to that conversation? Who gets to be in on that conversation?
Good question.
I just wonder who's, I mean, it always sounds good to me, it's what I do, to sit down and talk with people about things and talk it out and everybody come to an agreement, but who gets to be there?
I think that is the question, the million-dollar question here. Who gets to be there? Are women going to be part of this? And I'm going to jump in right now and say that, you know, as a practicing Muslim woman, I believe that, you know, our Prophet came to save women from being buried alive, because pre-Islam in Arabia, newborn girls were buried alive. And today I feel that women are metaphorically buried alive again due to practices that are in some ways sanctioned by Sharia, which is female genital mutilation, honor killings, forced marriages. And I would invite both the gentlemen who are listening to watch Honor Diaries and, you know, see how women are almost enslaved again under certain aspects of Sharia. So I agree that it needs to have open debate and discussion if we follow the path of the Prophet. And Sharia is also linked to economics. It is easiest implemented in totalitarian regimes, the kind of Sharia that we see, and in places where they fear an economic downturn, and Brunei is a perfect example. What we see happening in Brunei today is a perfect example of picking and choosing the kind of Sharia that they want. The Sultan of Brunei is no saint. I mean, he has lived a life of luxury and lechery, but now, because there's going to be no oil in 2035, how does he control his people? He controls them by implementing a harsh form of Sharia where they are going to discriminate, you know,
just
property,
in recent weeks, he's instituted
this. Gays and homosexuals, mm-hmm. and, you know, the laws of blasphemy come into play. I mean, these are terrible atrocities where people are murdered in the name of these aspects of Sharia. And, you know, we have to put all of this on the table with Islamic scholars. In my documentary, Dr. Abdulaziz Sachedina, who is my mentor and one of the most accomplished Islamic scholars in North America, has said, whose Sharia is it anyway? That there needs, before Muslims can talk about bringing Sharia law to the West, they must sit down and reform aspects of it. And from my perspective, I say that the concept of armed jihad today must be rejected, because it is giving empowerment to terrorists like the Boko Haram. And coming to Boko Haram, I believe that Michelle Obama's statement that this is being done in the name of not educating women does not cover the whole story. It is being done in the name of their understanding of Sharia law. And this is something that all of us need mm-hmm. to talk about.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You were listening to Raheel Raza. She's president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow. Also with us, Jafar Mahalati is an Oberlin College Presidential Scholar in Islamic Studies. And also with us, Dr. Thomas Kasulis. He's director of the Center for the Study of Religion at OSU. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jafar Mahalati, let's go back to that question of who should be at the table when Muslims talk about Sharia law and what it means in today's through the prism of modern times?
I think everybody should come to the table, the secular, the atheist, and fundamentalists and reformists. All wide range of people should come to the table and discuss what really serves humanity at this juncture. Previous speaker talked about armed jihad. I've written my own thesis on ethics of war in Islam, and this is yet another concept that's been heavily abused. And not only in Islam, we know that 200 years of crusades was done in the name of Jesus. And when, as a Muslim, I look at the image and visage of Jesus in Quran, it's abhorring that in his name 200 years of war was conducted. So abuse is abundant. The question is that, should we bring all those within or our discussion should be inclusive or exclusive? And I go heavily against any kind of exclusivist perspective. And there are some very important, very recent and historic, historically important experiments. Look at Iran and Turkey. Compare the situation in Iran and Turkey. In Iran, after 1979, religion came all the way into politics. Now you see that a very reformed religion right there. In Turkey, it was pushed back, and it takes a much longer time for religion to adapt certain features for the religious people to adapt certain features of modern life. So that is the advantage of inclusive approach, if I may say.
I think one of the things I would like to interject here, because I think we are agreed that everybody should be at the table. The problem is how to work that out. And I think one of the things that we have to bear in mind is that if I am a Muslim and someone is claiming that what they are doing is Islamic and in accord with Muslim teachings, and I cannot identify with that, it becomes incumbent on me as a Muslim to say that is not Islam as I understand it. That is not our Islam. And to be able to marshal history, interpretation, and even Sharia law as part of my argument that there is something very wrong here.
When you look at Christianity, we know there are lots of different ways that people approach their Christianity. They interpret it lots of different ways. I think you mentioned, or perhaps it was Jafar Mahalati, what they're going to pull out of the Bible, what they're going to quote, and that sort of a thing. Why do we have a different view of Islam when it comes to Sharia law? Why is it harder for, over the larger society to accept that there's lots of different interpretations of that, too?
Well, part of the issue is just historical, that with the, first of all, Christianity did not originally emphasize the idea of law in the way that its predecessor Judaism did. In fact, Jesus had a lot of problems with the Pharisees because they were becoming too legalistic in his mind. But then with the Constantinian making of Christianity into the official religion of the Roman Empire, it became very legalistic, very doctrinal. But then that meant that the center of this doctrinal development was in Europe and all the way to the east to Constantinople, now Istanbul. And so in that area, there was also gradually the change of the Renaissance, the Reformation, new kinds of thinking, the development of new kinds of political thinking, and that intersected with it. What we have in some of the rest of the part of the world that Islam is dominant is a very different historical pattern in relation to the law. And so part of the thing was that Islam was the civilizing force in many of the countries it went into. There was chaos, political chaos, until Islam entered. So therefore, Sharia law and secular law, or if we want to call it normal political law, was the same thing for many of these countries. And so only now in the 20th century do you have this kind of transformation of the situation and creating this new issue. And it seems to me this is one of the most important issues for Muslims as individuals in their tradition to face, is how, because basically many of the countries we're talking about in the Islamic world still have a strong element of theocracy. That is, religion rules the state, and mm-hmm. secular laws are there just to aid religion in ruling the state. That idea is exactly the idea that was overthrown at the end of the medieval period in the West. By that, I mean Europe and the Christian world. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that world has had 400 years to deal with this. And so therefore, oddly enough, we then say the opposite. They say, well, of course you have freedom of speech and freedom of religion. That's because there are many religions. But from the standpoint of Islamic countries, this is a relatively new idea, and even more new for some of them is to say there are many Islams just as there are many Muslims. And so therefore, how are we going to define, say, an American Islam? How are we going to define a Canadian Islam?
Rahil Raza, is that what it seems like to you, that we're talking about different
Okay, so yeah. I just want to point out that while I really appreciate the two gentlemen speaking about academically and about historical mm-hmm. Facts, I want to respond to two of the comments. Dr. Mahalati, you spoke about Iran. I mean, this is a country where there is no personal individual freedom for women. They're imprisoned for speaking out. So how can we talk about any kind of progress when there is no gender equality? And I know I'm harping on this because I am a Muslim woman. To me, one of the major aspects of what I reject about Sharia law is the fact that women are not given equal rights. So when we talk about bringing people to the table, yes, of course, equal number of women, and you talk about Turkey. The same thing is now happening mm-hmm. in Turkey. Yes, it's, you know, it used to be an example of a country that was pluralistic. But now, if the president is telling women that they should not wear red lipstick, I have a huge problem with that. I mean, as a Muslim woman, the individual freedoms I get in a liberal democratic society and the laws of this country are very good for me. I am able to practice my Sharia or whatever my moral and ethical practices are in my daily life. But Muslims, when they sit together around the table, have to speak about separation of church and state, especially Western Muslims. And that is the focus for our future generations, that they don't need a second set of laws. I mean, this is my understanding. And Dr. Kasoulis, you mentioned that, you know, Muslims, there are different interpretations. Very true. Of course they are. And for someone to look at something negative and say this is not our Islam, I'm sorry, I don't agree with you, because that is deflection. So when we look at Boko Haram, many Islamist organizations have made this statement and said, well, you know, that's not our Islam. But what are we doing then? We are removing ourselves from an issue that is creating a worldwide problem. And we are not picking up on what needs to be discussed and debated. And it's the same thing over and over again. You know, for over hundreds of years, we have not really brought to the table the issue of the treatment of women. We haven't brought to the table why cutting of hands and stoning and gender oppression is still taking place in the 21st century as we speak. If everything was as noble as it seems, then these problems would have been solved, but they have become worse. If a girl like Malala Yousafzai, who comes from the land where I come from, is shot in the face for wanting to be educated, mm-hmm. the whole Muslim world should have been up in arms, and all our scholars and academics and religious leaders should have been lobbying for change. But I don't see that change coming. Maybe you do, and you are much more positive than I am.
I'm going to just take a break right here. My guests and I will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about Sharia law this hour. It's often cited as the basis, the justification for kidnapping, violence, and oppression around the world, but many Muslims say it's misunderstood. There's lots of different interpretations. One may not be another's. Still with us is Rahil Raza, author, filmmaker, and president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow. Jafar Mahalati, he's a scholar in Islamic studies at Oberlin College. And in the studio with me, Dr. Thomas Kasoulis, he's director of the Center for the Study of Religion at OSU. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Jafar Mahalati, how does Sharia law translate into the daily lives of a typical Muslim in America? And I know we've already made the point there's kind of no such thing as a typical Muslim, but be that as it may.
First of all, I would like to say that when I refer to Iran, I'm by no means an advocate of any kind of theocracy. I don't believe that it works. So my reference to the case of Iran is not in support of the political system.
Understood.
Necessarily. Mm-hmm. However, I want to mention one thing to what Ms. Reza mentioned, and she's sort of coming close to the idea of personal Sharia, in the sense that everybody has a sort of freedom to interpret his own Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a sort of, I would call it catch-22 situation, because it is exactly on the basis of that loose authority that we now see Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda in the world. And this is one of the major problems. So we have to be very conscious when we talk about personal Sharia. That loose authority also, it has its own evils.
Is there an essence of Sharia law that suggests proselytizing, that suggests
just a minute,
conversion?
Dr. Mahalati, let me quickly respond. I was absolutely not saying that people need to interpret Sharia personally. That's, in fact, the part of the problem. I'm totally against that. What I'm saying is that scholars and Islamic scholars and experts and religious leaders need to get together and bring Sharia into the 21st century.
So
that there is
100%.
One sort set of, factors that people can follow. The problem is that people are interpreting Sharia personally and using all sorts of negativity to implement it. So I just wanted to make
points.
That correction.
Thank you. I have to put it. Thank you very much. I absolutely agree with you that one of the problems is that we don't have organized centrality on the question of authority and the silence of authority, the silence of ulama is one central problem to all of what we are addressing.
Yes, absolutely.
It's very important, and I 100% agree with you that ulama should not be silent. Boko Haram should have been condemned by every clergy in every city, every village. No question about it. I would like to ask to answer the second question, which is the question of Islam in America. Mm-hmm. I have actually my own theory that Islam is coming to America in two diverse ways. One was through the slaves who were brought here, and then went back to the study of Islam, after in the second part of 20th century, and those who immigrated here. And now the interest of so many scholars, we are having a very interesting production of Western Islam that is actually being exported to the motherland. And this is phenomenal. This is, I think, a new phase of Islamic civilization that is well-worked. It is definitely compatible with modern features of life everywhere. And that's why it is being exported. And let me give you one example. If I go to a bookstore in Tehran or in Cairo and go to Barnes & Noble in New York, I see many more books translated on Islam, translated from English into Persian and Arabic and other languages, that students now, university students study in Tehran, in Cairo, and in Islamabad, than the other way around. And therefore, the state of Islamic scholarship in the United States specifically is a very... good phenomenon that is a part of transforming our perspective of Sharia across the globe.
Thomas Kasulis, you agree that this is there's more and more interest in it as a scholarly pursuit?
Well, I think that's the case. The question is whether the scholarly pursuit connects to the everyday life, or does it connect with other scholars? Scholars like to talk to other scholars and read each other's works. But I want to say here, lest I be misunderstood, that what Raheel is advocating is exactly what I'm talking about. She is speaking as a Muslim woman demanding there be change. That's my point. She's not speaking as a modern Canadian saying there must be change. She's speaking as a Muslim saying that there must be change.
And I think that's a modern Muslim Canadian woman.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly my point, right. Is that those multiple identities are exactly what is negotiated in the contemporary world. And that's what Islam, like every religion, needs more and more good examples of. How can I be both Canadian and Muslim and a woman and be able to stand for all of these different identities? And the only thing that can stand for identities, again, is the person. And that's exactly what I think is needed, is this engagement of Muslims as persons saying, I am a modern person and I am Muslim. And the only way I can make this work is if this stops, and this starts, that starts.
Mm-hmm.
And making that an agenda. Because you are saying you're a Muslim woman, that means it will not be a total disconnect in any way from Sharia. It won't be a total disconnect from the traditions of the Quran and the Hadith. It'll be connected to that because that's part of what you are as a Muslim. And that's what you have to bring to the table.
Yes. But Raheel? Then because I understand that there is no compulsion in religion, I feel that a lot of this is a personal choice of how I decide to interpret it and live my life. Mm-hmm. And in answer to your question about how North Americans practice Sharia in their day-to-day life,
mm-hmm.
how North American Muslims, I would say that as a moral and ethical guidance, it guides us for birth, death, marriage. Both my sons are Canadian Muslims. They had their nikah in a mosque ceremony, although they have married non-Muslim women. But, it's the foods we eat. It's our connection with each other. And as Dr. Kasulis said, yes, I am demanding change, but and change that Islam can be relevant to our future generations in the 21st century. You will agree with me, Dr. Kasulis, that unfortunately many, many Muslim organizations and Muslims are regressing in time, and some of them have this idea that they want to implement that the only good Muslim is a 7th or 8th century Muslim.
I agree completely.
Why is that? Why?
Well, just yesterday, that Muslims should not fly aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Right. Why is that happening? Who wants to take a stab at that? Why is there this regression when the essence of Sharia law is evolution?
I will let one of the scholars answer that for you.
Well, has it happened before? Is there another pattern like this in history that you can look back at?
There are. One of the phenomena of the last 400 years, and it's happened to different religions at different points, is the issue of what does modernization mean for us? For Christianity, that was the struggle in the Renaissance. Does the church tell us whether the sun goes around the earth, or does science tell us whether the sun goes around the earth? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Who decides? And that was not an issue a couple hundred years before that. And so there. In the case of Islam, I think it's been a relatively later phenomenon. So whenever there's that point when modernization comes up, there's always going to be a reactionary group that says, no, don't change it. And what they want to do is they have a vested economic, political, personal investment in the status quo.
Right.
And so therefore, change is frightening to them. And so they fall back on, all I am being is a traditional good fill in the blank.
Right.
Judaism went through the same thing with having to deal with Reform Judaism versus Conservative Judaism versus Hasidism and so forth. Which mm-hmm. way do we go? And there's always going to be a tension among people when they face modernization and the so-called new way of thinking about individuality, rights, and so forth, and how that is going to intersect. And you're going to have groups going in two directions. My only point is that There's a Japanese philosopher who talked about how did philosophy in Japan get implicated in the fascism of the war years. And he pointed out that what it was he called it a tug of war over words. That is, the same words were being interpreted differently by what we would call the left and the right. You could see this in American politics. I don't know a single politician who's against family values. On the other hand, you ask them to define what family values are, you're going to have an extraordinary range. So dealing with Sharia law or Islam, we're going to have to expect the same kind of variety. And what has to be done is that people have to stand up and say, no, that is not the right way to interpret it. This is what we stand for. This is what is the only future for Islam in the modern world, and so forth.
If I may have one comment on it, compliment, is that not only facing modernism and the threat of modernism, as Dr. Casula is mentioning, but also we should have in mind that it's fairly recently that Muslim countries have come out of 200 years of colonization. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the two last centuries have put so many Muslim countries on reactive mode,
right?
Reaction almost to anything, because of the fact that they were colonized and they were very unhappy about that, and they were also thinking that in the past and various pasts, there was golden age of Islam and they were on the top of the world in terms of progress and welfare. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that kind of reactive mode has to pass. So I would say that, and I see that, signs of it in countries like Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, that now they are approaching a non-reactive sort of, approach to life altogether, which comes in politics and, economics and, every walk of life. So I would say part of fundamentalism should be explained, in terms of, extreme reaction to the past. And what we need to tell Muslim countries at this time is not only to talk about how we have to reform Sharia or look with a reform eye into Sharia, but also get rid of our reactive mode. Mm-hmm. And the past is past, and start a future which is not reactive but rather active.
But that takes time, Rahil Raza. You're impatient. And meanwhile, back at the ranch in Nigeria, there's almost 300 girls who have been kidnapped. It seems to be getting worse before it gets better, right?
Yes, and I'm impatient because there are lives at stake.
That's right.
I'm impatient because, reform does not happen overnight. We know that. But at least we have to light a fire under the heels of our academics and our scholars, present company accepted, of course. But, I cannot bring about the reform. I can only support it. I can speak about it. I can lobby for it.
Right.
But until and unless blasphemy laws and apostasy laws and minority killings and sectarian killings are condemned openly, and until they stop, we can't really bring about change. Muslims need to get over the victim mentality. I understand that, we were colonized. I come from a country that was colonized. But the point is that we have to, leave the past behind and look at history so that we can move ahead with our stories, so that we can bring about the necessary changes, so that Islam is then looked upon by the younger generation as a humane, gender-friendly, compassionate, spiritual, beautiful tradition, which it was, which is the core spiritual message, and that's what keeps me going.
And to look back in history, you must be educated.
That brings
us full circle. Jafar Mahalati, Oberlin College Presidential Scholar in Islamic Studies, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I learned a lot from our colleagues.
Rahil Raza, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Rahil Raza, she's president of the Council for Muslims Facing Toronto. And Dr. Thomas Kasoulis, director of the Center for the Study of Religion at OSU, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to Emmy Beach for producing this show, for All Sides producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, and a whole slew of volunteers, Justin English, Julia Hyder, Leticia Wiggins, Olivia Rojas, our student intern. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.